WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Jason Epstein has worked in the publishing industry for about half a century, and he finds the industry in a state of increasing distress. He explains why in his new book, Book Business, Publishing, Past, Present, and Future. Epstein is the former editorial director of Random House. The roster of illustrious writers he has edited includes Norman Mailer, Vladimir Nabokov, Philip Roth, and Gore Vidal. In 1952, Epstein created Anchor Books, the first literary paperback company. He also co-founded the New York Review of Books and created the Library of America, whose goal is to keep in print great American literature. Epstein says that one of the biggest changes he's seen is the gradual disappearance of independent bookstores and their replacement by chain stores located mostly in suburban shopping malls. I asked him how he thinks this has affected how books are published and sold.
The old independent bookstores were really run by mostly by people who didn't think of them primarily as businesses but as vocations, which is how most publishers back in the 50s and 60s thought of themselves too. But when those stores went out of business as their customers left the cities for the suburbs, they were replaced by stores that had to pay substantial rent in those shopping malls. And therefore, they had to have a lot of turnover, and that meant bestsellers, a constant stream of them. And that put a certain kind of pressure on publishers to produce those bestsellers. And it was not a change for the better, but it was a change. You can't do anything about change. It happens.
So you're saying that the emphasis on big profit margins has more to do with changes in retailing than it has to do with the fact that conglomerates have bought up most of the publishing companies.
Yeah, I think that the shift in the nature of the business occurred back in the middle 60s when the chain bookstores, which were then relatively small stores, not the kind of superstores we have now, but small stores called B. Dalton and Walden, and you saw them in shopping malls and airports and so on, needed a certain rate of turnover. They had to move their inventory very quickly and find new bestsellers to replace last week's bestsellers and so forth. And they couldn't stock backlist books that don't sell very briskly, but for which there's a more or less permanent demand. When Bennett Cerf, who owned Random House when I worked there, bought Alfred Knopf and joined the two firms together, he said that we could stop publishing books, new books altogether, and live on our backlist. It was like picking up gold from the sidewalk, he said. And he was right. But of course, we didn't want to go out of business. We wanted to be there and go on publishing new books, mostly to add to the backlist. But what happened when the bookstores moved up to the suburbs in those shopping mall stores, it became increasingly hard to sell the backlist. And that put even greater pressure on publishers' profits.
Do you think that the conglomerates who bought most of the publishing companies are making the kind of profits that they expected to make?
I don't know what they're doing at the moment. I think in the long run they will not make the profits they expected to make, no. I think they made a mistake buying these companies, and they'll discover that sooner or later.
What's the mistake? Why is it a mistake?
Because they won't find that they're profitable. In the short run, they may show some profits by getting rid of redundant overheads. If they put two companies together, they can shrink the warehouse. They can have one rather than two. They can reduce some of the back office expenses. But what they're going to end up with after they've done all that is a handful of essentially unprofitable publishing companies. I don't mean to say that all publishing is unprofitable. School publishing, for example, school and college publishing can be very profitable, but that's not the same as the publishing we're talking about. Here we're talking about what's called trade book publishing. That is fiction and nonfiction for general readers rather than for specialized audiences. And that kind of publishing is not in its nature profitable. It can't be. And
why not? Why can't it be profitable?
Because it depends too much on chance. Because publishers will very often choose to publish a book that, for other reasons than profit. Such books, if they are as successful as publishers hope they will be intellectually, let's say, become part of the culture and they sell for years, but in the short term they won't be profitable. It's a highly risky business. It can't be predicted. You don't know what's going to happen with your list when you announce it. you hope for the best, but you don't often, you're not often right about your guesses. And you don't go into it to make money. That's not the idea. Bennett Cerf, in his memoirs, was very clear about that. He said that he and his partner, Donald Klopfer, never expected to make money in the business. That's not what they were doing there. And I think that was true of the other people in his generation.
But they ended up getting rich.
But only by selling the business.
Oh,
that's
okay.
When they got rich. Well, they were, first of all, they were rich to begin with, otherwise they couldn't have done this.
True.
And they were paying themselves very small salaries, less than in many cases than they were paying their editors and the rest of their staff. And it wasn't until they unexpectedly sold the business to RCA, they weren't planning on that, they could never have foreseen that, that they made something like real money.
How do you think the job of editors has changed because of changes in retail and because of changes in the publishing industry, for example, how they're mostly owned by conglomerates?
Well, that hasn't changed at all as far as I can see.
You don't think there's more pressure on editors now to buy books that will be bestsellers?
Yes, there is, but the good editors can deal with that. The editors that I see at Random House, I still go there occasionally, though I'm no longer part of the firm, are devoted to serious books, books that will last, books for which the potential profit is really secondary, in the short run at least. And they're indispensable because the skills required by an editor are very hard to find. A strange combination of skills. And there aren't too many people who are good at that, but the ones who are good at that are just terrific. I think they're as good as they ever were, and they pay no attention to the conglomerate managers. They just do their work, just the way you do.
Some people who have been in publishing for a long time, like yourself, you've been in publishing for a half a century, some of those people are pretty skeptical about some of the changes now in electronic publishing, internet publishing. You're not. You're pretty enthusiastic about what you see.
Well, that overstates it. I don't like progress. I wish the world would stop. I wish the world had stopped 25 years ago. But it doesn't. It keeps on changing, and nothing I can do about that. And I think the changes that are going to be brought about by electronic publishing are inevitable, for better and worse. Therefore, we might as well face up to them, which is what I've tried to do. And when I say for better or worse, I mean that, because I think there are some very, very benign aspects of this shift we can look forward to.
What are you looking forward to?
It's very hard to predict in detail when you have a huge technological shift like the one that we're now experiencing, when a book can be transmitted directly from its author to its reader with no intervening steps, because that's what electronic publishing means. Any more than you could have guessed when you saw the Wright brothers take off from Kitty Hawk what a 747 would look like eventually. But you do know that something important has happened, that a major change has taken place, even if you don't know in detail. What I think will happen, and this is a guess, but it's an educated guess, is that in the future, most books will be sold electronically, but in printed form. They'll be printed on demand at remote locations. You'll log on to a vast catalog of titles, of titles that have been digitized and are available electronically on your home computer. You'll choose the book that interests you. You'll be able to browse it on your screen at some length, maybe the entire book. And if you want to buy it, you'll push a button, and on your screen will come a message saying that your book is now printed and available at the Kinko's store at the corner of Main and Elm Street. You can come pick it up, or we'll deliver it to you. I think that's what's going to happen, and I think that's going to make books, physical books, available to people in the most remote corners of the earth. And that will produce such changes as can hardly be imagined at this point. When you think of the changes that Gutenberg's invention, the printing press, produced in Europe, where until that time books had been made by hand by monks in monasteries in Latin where no one could read them. And you think of what happened in the years after the 15th century when books became everybody's property and they were written in vulgar languages, that is, in local languages, not in Latin. That produced our civilization. We wouldn't be here if not for that. Just think of what's going to happen now when books will be available not simply to everybody in Europe and its related countries, but all over the world.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jason Epstein. He's the former editorial director of Random House, and he is the co-creator of the New York Review of Books and author of a new book called Book Business, Publishing Past, Present, and Future. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jason Epstein, and he's the former editorial director of Random House. He's the co-founder of the New York Review of Books and the author of a new book about publishing called Book Business, Publishing Past, Present, and Future. You're responsible for some innovations in publishing. In 1952, you were the head of Anchor Books, the first head of Anchor Books.
Well, I wasn't the head of it. I invented it.
And you invented it, the creator of Anchor Books. And this is the publishing company that kind of created the literary paperback. What was the state of the paperback before?
Well, when I first came into the business in 1950, 51, I guess, paperbacks were mostly reprints of previous season's popular fiction, or they were westerns, mysteries, category books like that. But the serious kinds of books that Anchor published, the kind of books that I'd been reading as an undergraduate at Columbia, and that my contemporaries, of whom there were now millions with the GI Bill and so on, were reading, were not available in paperback. And it occurred to me that it would be a valuable thing to make paperback editions of them. It would sell for a little bit more than the kind that were sold in newsstands and drugstores, popular novels. But they would also be better produced with better paper, better binding, and so on. And that worked, and it created what was called at the time a paperback revolution. I never quite thought it was a revolution, but it did change the industry. It created, it was the first of those so-called quality paperback series.
What were some of the first books you brought out on Anchor?
Oh, let me see. One of them was Edmund Wilson's intellectual history of the French and Russian Revolutions called To the Finland Station. One was Stendhal's great novel, The Charterhouse of Parma. One was a wonderful book by D.H. Lawrence called Studies in Classic American Literature. And there were other books of literary criticism, philosophy, and so on. But books of that level, the kind of books that we were reading in as undergraduates in college in those days. And it became an immediate success, and within a year or two, everybody else was doing it. And then it created this, what is now the dominant form in which books are published.
Were there any parts of the experiment that were unsuccessful?
No. Well, for me, the part that was unsuccessful was a success because I don't like running things. I like inventing things, but running businesses and whatnot I found rather tiresome. So I was very pleased to turn Anchor Books over to other people for those purposes within a year or two. And I began looking around for other things to invent. And a few things turned up. But I don't like running businesses. It makes me very nervous.
Something else you created, the Library of America. You co-created that in 1979. Describe that.
Well, that began in a conversation with my dear friend Edmund Wilson, who was, in his time, probably the most powerful literary critic in America. He was actually a literary journalist. He didn't think of himself as a critic. He thought of someone who explained literature to other people. Anyway, he invited me for a drink one day at the old Princeton Club, which used to be on just south of Grand Central on Park Avenue, and we were at the bar, and he ordered half a dozen martinis, something I never heard anyone do previously. And not one of them was for me, by the way. He asked me if I wanted a half a dozen, and I said no. I might get one of his, but I didn't. And he said, well, what you should do, he said. And he was very peremptory. He didn't ever go in for introductions or beating around the bush. He said, what you should do is put all the standard American writers, Hawthorne, Melville, Twain, Poe, etc., into permanent, reasonably complete or actually complete editions, like the French, who had a series called the Pléiade, in which all that literature was available. I thought that had to be a non-profit business. I thought because you might sell enough of Melville and James and so on to keep the thing afloat, you wouldn't sell enough of some of the minor writers that we also had to publish. So I decided we would try to raise funds from foundations. And to make a long story short, it took 25 years to raise the necessary funds from foundations. of course, it became very successful and now is exactly the series that Wilson envisioned all those years ago at the Princeton Club Bar. Little compact books, short and stout like himself, he said, that produced the major and sometimes the complete works of the important American writers in very good editions on fine paper, and they can be conveniently carried in a raincoat pocket like his own. And we can be very proud of that. I'm delighted by that. But again, I have nothing to do with it these days.
I want to ask you about one of the writers you worked with, and that was Vladimir Nabokov. You didn't edit Lolita, but you did recommend that your company publish it, controversial though it was. Mm. But you and Nabokov split off for a political difference. Would you describe what happened?
Well, what I discovered when I came to know Vladimir, whom I liked very much, is that he was really determined to go back to Russia as he had known it as a young man, and his father had known it. They were came from a great old noble family, the Nabokovs did. And as far as he was concerned, the communists were temporary usurpers who would soon be got rid of. He was right about that, but not for the timing. It took a little bit longer. And so when the Vietnam War came along, he was all for it. He thought that that would help him reclaim the family estates in Russia. He was wrong, of course. They could never have had that result. And I was very much opposed to the war in Vietnam, because I thought that was not the way to deal with our Soviet enemy. Though we never had a discussion of that, we never confronted each other over that. Our friendship ended, I think, temporarily. I had been his literary executor, and I was no longer his literary executor, and we stopped communicating with each other, and so on. And I lost track of him until one day in Paris. It was a day in August when nobody was around. It was a Sunday, and I smoked cigars in those days, and there were none in the hotel I was staying in. So I walked around the corner to the Ritz to see if they had a cigar. And in the corner of the bar, I saw a man in a loud Hawaiian shirt speaking in a loud Midwestern voice, accent, American. And it was Vladimir celebrating his American status in a country that was becoming increasingly anti-American. So I went over and we sat and talked for a while, and we had dinner that night, and I proposed a toast to three Americans in temporary exile, the Nabokovs and myself. And he proposed a toast in return to Richard Nixon, thinking that would offend me. And his wife was very upset. Vera said, "Oh, dear, Vladimir, don't do that." And it made no difference to me. I toasted Richard Nixon, and he was, after all, our president. And we parted friends, and that was the last time I ever saw him. But he was determined to go back. And the irony is that I read somewhere that the Nabokov mansion in St. Petersburg was eventually liberated and bought by one of those 20-year-old instant ex-Soviet millionaires, someone in the computer business who set up a kind of disco in it. But that would have been a Nabokovian twist. He might have been amused by that, or perhaps not.
Well, Jason Epstein, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's a pleasure.
Jason Epstein is the author of Book Business. This is Fresh Air.